Monday, February 15th. Happy President's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day today.
Happy Valentine's Day today.
You can't.
Happy Lunar New Year. Mm-hmm. It's a weekend full of celebrations.
Can't say Happy President's anymore. President's Day has been canceled. California, as your former boss, Ezra Klein, mentioned, we are doing politically toxic renamings. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, they're both out, of course.
Cancellation is canceled. It's today's love day. Today's the day when you tell a podcast that you love them. The wind is growling out there.
Yeah.
Everyone's feeling weird. This episode is going to be a wild one. I can already tell just from the wind.
Plus, it's a morning record, which is always...
It's a morning record. That's
always
weird.
Always a red flag.
Yeah.
A lot of red this weekend. Red flags.
Yeah.
Lunar New Year. Valentine's Day. Red states winning.
Yeah. We're not going to talk about that. I promise. I promise. Scott, you have any housekeeping that you'd like to take care of?
Yeah. Okay. So we have... For actually not just our Sepulveda Pass listeners, we have a new episode of TMZ coming out. It is on Ingrid Goes West. This was our honorarium for the Sundance Film Festival, which is all digital this year. We are honoring them by doing a previously awarded movie from Sundance. It's a great episode. We're doing it in front of the paywall. Listen to that. And if you like it, you can join the Sepulveda Pass for the cost of 2 seconds worth of LAPD overtime that we are definitely going to talk about later. I was also on High and Mighty with John Gabris this past week talking about public transportation.
Awesome.
It was a lot of fun, and definitely listen to that. Gabris is a big friend of the show. We had him on to talk about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang on a previous TMZ. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, we have a new round two of LA Jeopardy. I still can't say that, and we'll probably never be able to say it. Our Jeopardy game show that K-Town for All hosted in the past, Alyssa, of course, was the big winner. It was a ton of fun. We did it as a fundraiser for Theo Henderson of We the Unhoused last time, and this time it is a benefit for LA Cans EcoHood Project. ktownforall.org/jpod is... the link for that if you want to RSVP.
But that we'll be putting that up. That link is going to be around.
Yeah, we'll definitely shout that out as it gets closer.
Yeah, I already shared it from our Twitter, but I'll share it again. So you just look on our Twitter.
That's the 21st at 6 p.m., I want to say.
I believe it's 6 o'clock, yes. Yeah. No, it's at 8, guys. I'm just trying to make sure that I win.
We were all texting last night about, you know, the new COVID data. Oh, when the COVID data drops every day, you know the text thread is lighting up. And we were talking about how, look, everything's down. Hospitalizations going down. Like, unlike in previous surges in the pandemic where it would spike really fast and then very slowly decline, we're looking at kind of a symmetrical bump here in cases, hospitalizations. Deaths are still in the mid-hundreds every day, which is down from a few weeks ago, but it lags. It takes a little longer. And we were talking about how Gavin Newsom said that we were going to see like a roller coaster level decline in cases, and that's why he was opening up business. We were very skeptical that that was going to happen. I'm getting ready to take this L right now. I'm getting ready.
What?
I know you aren't. I know you aren't, Scott. Getting ready.
First of all, it was not a roller coaster level drop in cases. It was in ICU occupancy rates.
Right. But hospitalizations are dropping. All the curves look pretty much the same. Hospitalizations are dropping really fast, too. ICU occupancy, what we were talking, it's a weird thing where, like, they are taking beds offline. I assume they're reopening the gift shop to people who want to buy gifts instead of be intubated.
Right.
But, like, we are, like, I'm not saying that it was guaranteed that this would happen. It's probably to some extent a lucky break. But a combination of vaccinations, certainly nothing to do with the measures that the local governments took because they've been opening up, but vaccinations and tons of people having previously been infected, I think we are seeing a really quick drop in COVID cases. And the way that that will keep happening and will stay low is if we start really getting vaccines into arms. It's a phrase that Alyssa really loves.
So just to say, because I am absolutely not by any means taking an L on my skepticism about Gavin Newsom's decision making. So we have 10% vacancy, according to John Myers of the LA Times, Sacramento bureau chief there. 10% ICU vacancy rate in the Southern California region, as opposed to the 1/3 vacancy. That was a huge projected increase in the vacancy rate for ICUs throughout a vast majority of California, frankly.
And that was projected for a week from now, right?
Yeah, we're pretty far off from that. It doesn't seem like that's likely. But I also want to say I'm really hesitant to even engage with this line of discussion, frankly, because basically what that means is you're saying, is it okay to gamble with the
That's
lives?
Not what I'm saying. No, that's not what I'm saying.
Hold on. It is kind of what you're saying.
No, it's not. I think it could very easily have been a lucky break. I don't think it was safe to gamble at all.
So
but
gambling with tens of millions of people's lives is either good or not good, and not based on whether or not you gamble, you win the bet.
But the results are also good or not good, and the results are good. Like, they made, I think, a very risky, bad decision, and, like, the results, whether, like, or not it was right to do it in the first place, it's a good thing that fewer people are getting sick and dying of COVID. And I'm not accusing you of thinking that's a bad thing, by the way.
I'm just, I'm going to go with the Confucian response of we'll see. I'll just say it remains to be seen what the actual outcome of this is.
And there was no, I'll say this, there was absolutely no reason not to just wait a few weeks and for this to happen. If they were projecting it was going to happen this quickly, let's just see it happen. And then, yeah, sure, you can start. Yeah. If they started opening things up now on the other side of this huge decline, that would make a lot more sense than doing it when it was at the top of the peak. But I think we are fortunate that it hasn't cascaded into extending the surge or all the other nightmares that could have come of this.
I think if you want to talk about a real mistake, you look back at I looked at the exact date, but it was like November 15th, 16th, where cases were starting to already go up. This was before the holidays. And what did Gavin Newsom do at the state level that wasted at least a week of our time? Do you remember?
No.
A curfew.
Oh, wow.
Before we implemented anything else.
That's so funny. How could I forget?
So the signs were there. If you just want to talk about taking an L, I mean, we had a time where we saw cases start to tick up. We knew the holidays were coming, and we waited a whole week before we actually did anything. And everybody said a curfew is not enough. Everybody who does a curfew eventually has to go into deeper restrictions anyway. And there was a curfew in place. Just wanted to put that out there.
Everyone appears to have moved on to the policy focus being attempting to vaccinate people. Anthony Fauci says open season for vaccinations by April. Right now, it kind of feels like when my brother and I used to be obsessed with Beanie Babies, and you would hear that there was like a new shipment just got dropped at like Spencer's Gifts at the Barton Creek Mall or something, and then everyone would rush over there. The news would be there. This week, Dodger Stadium had one day where there were, I think, 7,000 appointments just unfilled for some reason. I assume some technical reason went wrong. And then they had to close for 2 days later in the week because they didn't have enough shots.
It was very strange. And this was something that Mayor Garcetti actually announced during his Thursday COVID show. And it was in keeping with themes that we've gotten used to during the course of the pandemic. It was not at all the fault of local administration. It's very much, he said, locally, we're doing everything that we can. The supply chain nationally is just a mess, and we're trying to deal with it. I think in part, that's pretty easy to credit as being true, but this was quite a strange swing from having an unexpected surplus of thousands of vaccines. What happened to those? Hopefully they did make it into people's arms, but I'm not sure that that's the case. They then said, yeah, we have no Moderna, none of the Moderna vaccine coming in, none of it on shelf. So we're closing the largest vaccination center. Not for much longer. I hear San Diego is going to beat us out pretty soon.
Yeah.
But we're going to have to close down the Dodgers Stadium site for several days until we get more vaccines in.
At the same time, you have Northridge Hospital giving out 100 vaccines to teachers at a private school who happily announced that they'd gotten this deal to their parents. A lot of the parents were upset that teachers had these teachers had jumped the line. Meanwhile, Austin Buettner, LAUSD superintendent, says that LAUSD needs 25,000 vaccinations to reopen. I assume that's double. I assume that's 50,000 shots.
Yeah. I think that's
right.
I'm
not sure. Do you know, Alyssa?
Well, isn't the number of teachers, the number of total teachers is 25,000,
okay.
Right?
Okay, yeah.
So
I assume it's a double shot.
So the first line of that article, which is from Howard Bloom on February 8th in the LA Times, is Superintendent Austin Buettner says vaccinating 25,000 teachers and staff could lead to reopening elementary schools for 250,000 students. So yeah, 50,000 doses.
So that's just for elementary schools, which people are elected officials and some people are focusing on. Is like that's what they want to get open right away and then go hybrid if you're in a high community spread area or something like that, which almost all of America still is, and keep middle and high schools remote. You had Catherine Barger, county supervisor, writing to Gavin Newsom saying open schools now. You have Joe Buscaino, the council member, still asserting that he wants to have schools opened in LA, wants LAUSD to open. Austin Buettner and the LAUSD board won't do it. But everyone is mad, and there was a column in the LA Times about this by Erica Smith, about the fact that some jobs, in particular, these weed delivery drivers, you hear about these weed men driving around with just like tossing it out the window out of the driveway, are authorized for vaccination as healthcare workers but before teachers are able to get the shot. There's been a lot of commentary on this and even in national media about like California is just so crazy.
Alyssa, you had I loved your take on this, which I don't know if you posted anywhere other than in our group chat.
What was it? What did I say?
Oh, about delivery drivers being from the same communities that people are always saying that they're trying to improve.
Of course, like you have
access.
You have the same column, like in the same opinion column in the LA Times. Like the next column over is like, hey, why aren't we vaccinating Black and Brown neighborhoods at the same rate as everyone else? And then this column is like, why would we vaccinate delivery drivers at dispensaries over anyone else? I'm like, well, why don't you look at who's doing the delivering of these at anything? It's all the same, right?
This column to me exemplifies a very LA Times frame of reference for Southern California, where you're just supposed to like feel outraged because like clearly the pot guy doesn't deserve to be vaccinated as they're doing something that is both low wage and high risk. Every delivery driver should be prioritized for getting this vaccine. And the thought that the state would consider marijuana medicine, I really just do not even care about the designation of delivery drivers as medical workers does not move me at all one way or another. But the thought that the state would use that designation to the extent that it is a useful fiction or whatever for consumers of pot within the state of California, and then turn around and be pissed off at workers trying to take advantages of the benefits that accrue to them because of that choice. First of all, Buscaino, Austin Buettner had a big come to Jesus moment together on Twitter where they were like holding hands and shaming the weed delivery drivers. Everybody is so thrilled that they have a villain that they can rally against. A San Diego newspaper posted something about common sense prevailing because they had successfully deprioritized cannabis drivers. And it's just like, who is this actually a victory for? I don't get it. I do not see it. I don't feel outraged that any low-income worker is successfully able to get vaccinated. It seems like a good thing to me.
And also in the realm of journalism that is questionable, there was a woman who died after receiving a vaccination. She was 78. Mm-hmm. Am I correct?
I think so.
And the headlines for, you know, it was not related. The story said that if you read the story, but all the headlines to feed into this, again, fear and our friends, the anti-vaxxer renegades who are just waiting again till we get more vaccination supplies so they can show back up at Dodger Stadium. The headlines are all like, woman dies after receiving vaccine. I mean, what? Why would we write that unless you just wanted it to be picked up in the wrong context and spread?
These are the same people also who were saying when people got COVID and mostly older people were dying, they were saying like, these people are old.
Uh-huh.
They were dying regardless. But now, if they died anywhere near getting the vaccine, you better believe it was the vaccine that killed them.
That's a good
point. Karen, is the picture of health until he got the vaccine. You know, I think the truth is there is no right way to do this. These judgments are totally arbitrary. If someone said like a grocery store worker is in front of more people on a daily basis than a delivery driver, I'd say like, yeah, okay. That makes sense. But like deciding when this it's space of a few months that's really important for saving lives, who goes first is impossible. And how it happened here was the most haphazard, panic-driven way it could have gone, where the first category was healthcare workers, frontline healthcare workers who were dealing with COVID patients all day long. And then the refusal rate was really high. It was like a lot of people were just not getting the vaccines. They were not getting the vaccines into arms very quickly. And so they basically made a snap decision and said, this category of healthcare workers needs to become a million people. I don't care how you do it. Like that is the population that we can serve right now, given the refusal rate in LA County. And so they added chiropractors, acupuncturists, and people that worked in medical marijuana, including...
And that made people mad, too, the acupuncturists. You saw the same types of headlines. California. Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Not
well, this
real.
Is medicine now. Yeah. And it's like, no, they're just like, there were terms for how they were going to give vaccinations out. It had to be healthcare workers. So they changed the definition of what a healthcare worker was to include way more people. Then they went to the age-based system. Then I've completely lost track of what's been happening. For a while, it was not incorporating medical vulnerabilities. Now it is again, I think.
Yeah, there's good news on that front. Really strong advocacy work on the high-risk CA hashtag. You can see it working as you look on Twitter. But they, I saw by March 15th, they would have all those groups incorporated that they were asking for, people with immuno issues, comorbidities, disabilities, all these things. So that was really great, a huge shout out and a great win for them.
And I posted this on Twitter, but like vaccine equity is not a thing that exists in America or frankly anywhere else. Honestly, at this point, it is a joke. People who pushed this line, and it was mentioned in the LA Times op-ed that we were talking about by Erica Smith. I think from her perspective, she was saying she's confused because the state has routinely said that vaccine equity is a priority to them,
mm-hmm.
but it's not clear from what they're actually doing. All of this is taking place in a context where we have the United States, other developed countries, particularly in Western Europe, China, China at least is actually making an effort to send the country, the authoritarian country that's committing genocide currently within its own borders, is making an effort to send tens of millions of vaccine doses to developing countries elsewhere, just to give you a sense of there being really no good actors here. But vaccine equity can't really exist or make sense in a situation where all of these first world countries are shutting out the vast majority of people in the world from having even a chance
right.
of getting vaccinated, which is exactly yes. what's happening. Anybody who says vaccine equity, meaning like we are going to have some sort of representational distribution of vaccines, which we don't have within the context of the richest country on earth, It is just virtue signaling. It doesn't mean anything in practical terms, and the impacts are bad globally. If you look globally,
sure.
the impacts are going to be very bad for a long time to come.
But even
and there are
yes,
two there are two Ebola mm-hmm. outbreaks in Africa right now in two different places where they are just like, are we really going to be hit by both these things at once and have still nobody vaccinated for COVID? It's
yeah.
just really. Really scary.
And
go
even
on,
but when you're talking about distribution of a vaccine, I do believe there is a balance where like it, taking time to achieve perfect equity of distribution is time in a situation where quick delivery is also a priority. I think
right.
there is a balance of like accepting a certain degree of mayhem and inequity because delivery, it does now appear what everyone suspected, which is that transmission is reduced also by someone getting the vaccine, that it does, someone getting the shot does make everyone safer. I think it's a definitely a worthy goal to achieve always, but so is speed. And this is just a stupid time. Inevitably, we're back to the job-based distribution now. I didn't even notice that happened.
The thing is, I don't think it's not inevitable, but it's the situation in which we find ourselves as a result of equity literally never having been a priority ever in the past. And so, like the distribution system that exists, I mean, we're going to talk about something very similar with EDD, like the unemployment insurance administering agency within the state of California. Like when your entire government has been structured in such a way that benefits are meant to accrue away from people most in need, particularly low income people, Black people, brown people, et cetera, like then, yeah, it once you are in a crisis, it then becomes extremely difficult and probably not the right time to restructure all of that infrastructure. However,
yes.
that being said, the dominant mode of governing is such that if you're not in a crisis, then you're derided for even bringing that up. Like, when would we have to think about doing this again? As soon as the pandemic ends, people will be, I am sure, ridiculed if they say, like, the next time that there is a once-in-a-century pandemic, we have to be prepared to focus on equitable distribution of vaccines.
Right.
That just will not be a conversation anyone is willing to take on. So it is not inevitable, but it is exactly the result of us just not caring about equity in general.
Yes. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Second best time is now. But, like, you're right that if you try to have the conversation after this is over, people will say, we just did this. Can we just please move on to
let people enjoy things.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Let them have brunch.
Exactly.
So let's talk about Project Roomkey. There was some action on Project Roomkey this week. Not a ton. There needs to be more. This, to me, is like one of the most important things that we possibly have going now in LA. Like an actual, genuine opportunity to make a significant dent in unsheltered homelessness in Los Angeles. We've talked about it. The federal government is now offering to reimburse 100% of the costs associated with emergency non-congregate shelters. FEMA is saying, we'll pay you back entirely. And non-congregate shelters means people having their own rooms to keep them safer from COVID. And the path to that is almost always leasing hotels and motels and putting people in them. We have a situation right now where we sunsetted Project Room Key. We never even got close to the goal of 15,000 rooms. We started sunsetting it because it seemed to be cost prohibitive at some point. It's retroactively reimbursed, so we're going to get about $30 million back from what we spent previously. And Garcetti is saying, we are expanding Project Room Key again. We're keeping some of the hotels that we're currently contracting with online through September, and we're adding a few hundred rooms, and the city is fronting the money to get that done, which is about $75 million. So that'll take the total number of rooms under Project Room Key to like 1,200, like maybe as much as like 1,500. It's adding a few hundred rooms back. There is another option, which is to absolutely go for broke on this program. We have literally a blank check on, even if it's temporary through September, scooping up as many leases on hotels as possible.
Yeah.
Using the entire, like, wartime footing on making this happen. And that I'm not seeing the urgency on, with the exception of basically three people on the city council, Mike Bonin and Nithya Raman, who put together the motion this week that was in Homelessness and Poverty Committee to really start going hard on Project Room Key, and Mark Ridley Thomas, who runs that committee and I think has expressed his firm commitment to making this happen. But then the agenda for the main city council meeting is already out. It's not agendized, that motion. Right. So now we're going to wait another week. We're on the clock. We only have through September. And meanwhile, this money from FEMA, we've talked about it, gets reimbursed really late. And like it's not going to come along for a long time. The city is not super liquid, but it doesn't feel like the mayor, the county is more to some extent, but they need to find this upfront money. This has to happen right now. It has to be happening this weekend. It has to be happening all this week.
Mayor Garcetti, during his COVID show last week, and his deputy mayor for homelessness also mentioned that this exact same issue, that they are working, well, they are, I guess, communicating with the Biden administration, trying to convince them of the need for more upfront funding. It is funny, like when we had David Rue, former city council member of District 4, and Mayor Garcetti using this language of FEMA style response, you do kind of wonder.
That was in reference to, by the way, something that had nothing to do with FEMA style anything. It was just like putting the power in the mayor's office. Now we could actually
FEMA response.
Right.
But we're rejecting that.
You have to wonder if, we are. We're not using that to the fullest, right? Like it's not apparently a priority to maximize this opportunity. And there is, I think, a lot of, I mean, we had this week Rich Llewellyn, the city's administrative officer, saying that we had the deficit ballooned from $650 to now $750 million projected, and that his office was actually recommending that every budgetary office within the city examine what invoices it could just not pay during this fiscal year, which sounds pretty dire.
It does sound
bad. This would save money. This would save them so much money over the long run. You look at the numbers from January. You know, we were getting close to four people dying a day at the end of last year, and now it looks like five people a day are going to be dying. I mean, if this is any, we didn't even have that bad of weather in January. So you really have to look at like what's going on here and how much worse is this going to get? And if we could save money by avoiding these cleanups, avoiding all this officer overtime, which we can talk about, you know, all this emergency healthcare. I mean, this could save the city so much money over the next year if we did this.
And when we're talking about these deficits, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of foresight to see, like, the federal government is coming to bail us out on that, too. Like, honestly, that, like, it got released this week that a part of Biden's stimulus package is a absolute fuck ton of money for state and local governments, including California, which has an enormous surplus, but yeah. Also the, like, large cities and counties are just getting this huge cash infusion that is basically going to obliterate this deficit in the city of LA.
So that, I mean, that I don't know if you have anything else you want to say specifically about Project Room Key. I think we've covered most of it, but that leads, I think, directly into something that we touched on last week, was this tentative deal for between city and LAPPL, the union that represents the LAPD. And because we know that we have this enormous cash infusion coming mm-hmm. from the federal government, where it is relatively predictable at this point in time, it does make the timing seem a little weird, right?
Like it totally does.
Why is this deal still necessary? And what is the city getting out of it? Hayes, do you want to like recap the specifics
of what the deal is?
Yeah, what we know so far.
Yeah, so the city has been trying to get all of the city employee unions to postpone these raises that they got in November of 2019, which already, this was boom times, November 2019, they put the city in the red. The raises were so huge. And so they had to like go around and start making cuts. And then COVID hit and we had this pandemic induced fiscal crisis. And so then the raises became a real problem. So SEIU, eventually the firefighters, all the mm-hmm. big unions agreed to postpone these raises in exchange for like a little guaranteed money down the road sometimes, but usually just like pushing the raises to avoid getting furloughed or laid off, which it looked like was going to happen. And the police union was the last one basically to make this deal. It's the biggest city employee union. It's like 10,000 officers. They agreed to postpone these raises in exchange for, you know, we talked about it last week, but they're gonna get all this money. It's just gonna be a little bit later, and they're also gonna get guaranteed overtime cash payments over the course of the next 3 years, about $70 million a year, plus the ability to pull out about $35 million more at the end of this process. What that means, people hear this and they're like, oh my god, like guaranteed overtime, like they're just gonna like get this money, like guaranteed number of overtime hours, but that's not really what it is. The police, the LAPD, just works and bills overtime totally at their own discretion. They just, like, it was in the LA Times this week that after the Dodgers won and the Lakers won and after the election, they just sent out basically every officer doing like round the clock overtime, and it cost $1.5 million just in overtime for those 3 days. What often happens is LAPD piles up overtime. The city can't pay it right away. They want to hold on to the money for something else. So they bank it and they say, we'll pay you this overtime, but later in your career, usually at the end of your career, and you get paid time and a half based on the salary at the time that you are paid it, by the way. So it's so if your pay is going up and you get those overtime payments later, it's a lot more money than if you just got them up front.
I mean, this is so it's a they call it overtime banking. It is similar in theory to, I think, a more accessible example for most people who have worked a salaried or hourly job is time accrued, vacation time accrued. If you earn time off and then you leave, you are required under state law to be paid out for that time that you've earned, and it gets paid out, of course, at your current salary, regardless of when it was earned. So that is maybe something that people are more familiar with.
So it was called in this LA Times article by David Zanizer and Kevin Rector, a really expensive credit card. That's basically what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so this deal requires, I mean, cops apparently don't want to save this money and get paid more later. A lot of them just want it now. the union talked about the cops are like, they want to buy houses, raise families, whatever. They want to be more liquid rather than wait for this huge amount of money to come when they're retired. So they want the money paid more quickly, and that's what this $70 million a year guaranteed means. It means that there will be a pool of overtime money that amounts to $70 million that will be paid out every year. But it's not saying, like, these aren't new costs. It's just saying that these costs have to be paid up front rather than later. And whether or not you think it is a good or bad idea to draw down the huge overtime bank that the city has accrued early rather than like waiting for those costs to go up by postponing them for a lot of years. I mean, like, that's, I think there are good arguments to be made on both sides of that, but it's not as clear as like, this is new money for the police department, because that's not really what it is.
I think that is a very useful frame of looking at this. And we've talked about this in the past, particularly during the course of last spring and summer when the Black Lives Matter protests were going on. But I do think that it is, I have a lot of questions about this deal. And I mean, there's the one that we led the segment with, which is this deal still even necessary at this point?
Like, yeah.
I really am curious. I think it's pretty clear what the LAPD get from this. They get a promise that they are going to get paid out during the course of a specific year up to a certain amount, which is, as you said, very popular with actual sworn officers who want to get paid for their overtime worked. It's less clear to me what the city is getting from this, especially as we may have a raft of like a liquid cash infusion coming from the federal government. We talked about it last week, just to remind our listeners, the raises in question, we had 4.5% raises for, I think, everybody represented by the LAPPL, more or less, coming in two increments during the course of calendar 2022, first in January, then in June. Now that is going to be delayed and all come at once in January of 2023, which is not a huge delay. That this is, it's really a deal that you would make if you were desperate, like really, really desperate, and saying, I mean, to think about the credit card metaphor, if you were just like, I really need to take out another loan, just like a bridge loan to carry me over for these next few months. And hopefully I'll be in a better financial position in January 2023 than I would have been a year or 6 months prior.
Good enough that I'll be able to pay these raises and also be able to pay, have the flexibility to pay this guaranteed overtime.
Yes.
Which is like, yeah, I mean, the city's in a tenuous position right now. I don't think there are any guarantees that we're going to be like fiscally thriving in a couple years. So in a sense, we are just putting money on the credit card again, but for like to pay sooner rather than later and reduce flexibility. So I get why people say that's an issue, but there are also people in the city that say like the whole premise of overtime banking is harmful. It's stupid. We should be paying down, without even making this deal, we should be paying down this money. It's not fiscally responsible to just let it balloon over like the ensuing decades. We're putting this on future generations at this point. So like, this is money that's owed. There is no getting out of this without declaring bankruptcy, basically. This is like a union contract. And so they're just saying like, we should pay this sooner rather than later. To me, we should get at the real issue with this, which is indiscriminate overtime working and billing.
Yeah, if you were less murdery as a police force, we wouldn't have to be doing these protests, and then you wouldn't have to be working overtime.
I mean, there are actually a lot of questions that,
but
that
that's
I have
an incentive, by the way. So they're saying like, wait, if we murder more people, then we can do
more overtime. Circle, yes.
I mean, so aside from that, you have, I think, the questions rightfully raised by Baba Akili in this Rector and Zonizer piece about, you know, is this an about face by the city on commitments that it had made however vaguely about reimagining public safety or what have you. I mean, if you were doing that, if you were actually saying like we're going to reimagine or whatever, I don't think that there's ever been any question that the city would follow through on something like this. But is it that bad of an idea to just go through with the layoffs? Politically, I get it. But like that is certainly, I think, something that needs to be addressed. Like, does it make more sense for the city to just cut police? Is that something that, and of course, we have the political engine of the LAPD. Michael Moore is getting in front of literally every camera within a 100-mile radius saying, you cannot cut police because look how many people are killing each other. It's American carnage on the streets. But I think that that is not really something that city officials ever would or did consider in making this deal.
Yeah. I think it's, and it's always like a question of like where, what's the priority of the moment in terms of like what would actually draw down the police department? Like you could go through with these layoffs, but based on what we're talking about with the federal government coming to bail us out, we don't really have to probably. Right. For like to be fiscally solvent in the city, because Biden is just coming with a dump truck full of money. One thing I think to pay attention to is new money that is actually going into the police department. As we were talking about, this is not new. This is not new money. New money is potentially being reviewed this week at city council. There's money going into the community safety partnership being discussed for that, which is 8, I think, public housing developments in LA, money for the LAPD to send armed officers there to engage with the community in positive compared to the traditional alternative ways.
Yeah.
It's a lot of like youth programming. And it's like walking around and getting to know people. But these are armed officers doing this job, and this is more money. This isn't reallocated within the LAPD budget. This is more money for LAPD. This is happening at the same time. That's new money. That's increasing the police department budget. And so it's impossible to do to keep track of where, like what is important happening at any given time. But to me, focusing on actually stopping new money from going in and drawing down the budget is more important than when we pay these overtime payments.
And I agree with that. I think that what I would say is something you just said, I think, is really the underlying point here. Following through with the layoffs is not necessary based on what we know, which obviates the need for any sort of deal making between the city of LA and the LAPPL. That is the premise for this bargain, is that
the only reason you would do it is if you actually want to pay down this overtime more quickly. Yeah.
But there is another thing that is happening as part of this deal, which was reported on by Zonizer and Rector, but it's been little picked up on social media, which is that part of this deal also is the extension of the existing LAPPL contract for 2 years.
Yeah.
So you are very much, I think Baba Akili is very much in the right when he says that this is coming at a time when increased scrutiny is being placed on police spending. We are losing 2 years for nothing. We're losing two years in which we can't negotiate on the terms of what is known to be, of course, a very, very generous union contract to the LAPPL. The terms of that will not be changed now until after 2024. We do have another contract coming up for LAPD, but that is for Metro, of course, pays them all in overtime as well. That's this summer. But like absolutely taking off the table any bargaining power when there is the most potential attention, city and public attention on this, is a big loss and for no real gain.
So that's it. Go ahead.
We also have, the whole conversation about changing who responds to certain calls.
Yep.
We haven't really gotten very far on that here in LA. And we already have 6 months of data from Denver, where immediately they made this change. And they just released last week that they had responded to, hundreds of calls a group of social workers or healthcare workers, whatever, it determined mostly dealing with people who were unhoused or people who are just, you know, having domestic problems a lot of times, and not a single arrest had been made. I mean, and they never had to call for backup. Wow. You know what I mean? So talking about overtime and how much you could actually change the way that we're responding to these calls. Just as an example, there was an article we didn't talk about last week about the LA's first lady, Amy Wakeland, called the police 80 times to come to the Getty Mansion, the Getty House, you know, just because of protesters or people being loud outside.
Yes.
That adds up.
And that's especially all OT. I promise you.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yes. Like 80 times. If just one person is allowed to do that 80 times. Mm-hmm. Who just happens to be the, you know, in the center of government of the city? How many more people are calling the police 80 times?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a really great point that there is kind of there's another way, which is even if you don't go through with the layoffs now, you just let the deal stay as is in order to be able to renegotiate it sooner, closer to when you supposedly are also going to be like reconsidering how we respond to calls. And if you want to pay down those overtime payments, you can do it if you want to. Like, you just leave yourself the flexibility as a city to do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
So feels weird to be, I mean, like, this is just like kind of adapting to new circumstances, but like a few weeks ago it did seem like really, really urgent to get these raises postponed to avoid devastating cuts in other areas of city government. But now that we don't have to make this deal, then maintaining flexibility to negotiate a better deal later with the union seems like a more appealing prospect.
You have to wonder if Brian Darcy of the IBEW and Craig Lawley are just like on a group chat where they just discuss how badly they wipe the floor with the mayor's office every time any kind of negotiations are opened. Probably. I do think, you know, that part of the harm that was done by the like Eight Can't Wait campaign of more incremental police reforms last summer, it gives the opportunity for organizations like the LAPD to say, hey, look, we already do six of these eight things and we're adopting the other two. And if these are the eight things that can't wait, then everything else by definition probably can wait. That is more of the approach that we've seen taken here. So in contrast to Denver, where we've got this data on great action that Alyssa just mentioned, by contrast, what we're doing here is the exact opposite. We are taking the known bad apples of the Metro unit and sending them back into South LA, where they have previously run rampant, accusing mm-hmm. people of gang ties that do not exist, falsifying evidence. We are now doing that anew and saying that it is a new effort. Jeff Gorel of the mayor's office, the deputy mayor for public safety, said that it bears no resemblance to previous Metro deployments in South LA, although they've only been there for 2 weeks. That sort of seems like a premature assessment to me. I don't know. What do you guys think about Metro being back on the beat?
It's not totally clear to me the extent to which it is happening. What I think about it is like, as a antidote for murders going up, it just mm-hmm. doesn't really make any sense. You get the feeling that the LAPD internally is like, well, you pulled these stops out of South LA, and now look what's happening. Murders are going up. We would have been prematurely arresting these murderers through our precog unit that patrols around and just like stops people.
Why not just name it that? Yeah. Why are we even saying Metro?
But
pre-crime.
Instead, you let them. You've let them stay on the street, and now they're killing each other. Murders are up everywhere. They're up in every city, in every major city in the U.S., basically, including ones that did not make these kind of policy changes. They're way up in Chicago. They're up in New York. They're up in every big city. So it doesn't have anything to do with that. It doesn't have to do with, I mean, the idea never made any sense. The L.A. Times has reinforced this, too, of like, with more cops on the street, there are fewer murders, as if in the couple hundred or less murders that happen in the city of LA every year. There are so many cops around that they're like somehow in the vicinity of a murder that's about to happen. And a murderer is like, oh, there's a cop.
Uh-huh.
I better not kill this person.
Metro was doing basically the LA equivalent of stop and frisk, the infamous Bloomberg era policy in New York City. Metro is responsible for just stopping every car that has a black or brown person in it and under whatever pretense recovering a gun, which is exactly what stop and frisk was for. And so, LAPD is not just internally, they're saying publicly that these kinds of changes are exactly the reason why crime is up in Los Angeles. There's not any evidence for that. And of course, there will not ever be any evidence for that. It's very difficult to prove causality in that. And no one is really interested in making that case. They just go in front of cameras and say, this is what's happening. Trust me, because I'm Michael Moore, chief of police. We should talk about another wave of crime, and that is benefits crime. We have managed not to talk about this story for a long time. It has been ongoing for several months now, and it is about EDD, which is the division of the State Department of Labor that is responsible for sending out checks and electronic benefits payments, debit cards to people who have lost employment as a result of the pandemic. This story gets really crazy. It seems like every couple of days there's something new. Alyssa, you just sent us a new story from this week about people leaving the department. I'm going to talk about that in just a second, but just so everybody knows, generally speaking, what's happening since the beginning of the pandemic. There was at least a massive expansion in eligibility for and payments for unemployment insurance. People were able to get, I think, at a minimum during part of the pandemic, they were able to get about $800 a week, which was very helpful to people who had lost their income source unexpectedly. And there wasn't even a question of them being able to find new employment elsewhere. So many people were newly unemployed. So EDD was handling these claims. They were doing a very poor job about it. The state auditor for California released two reports in the last couple of weeks. One that said they did a very poor job handling the spike in claims, which, although it was historic, EDD never had a sense of like how many claims it had to validate, how many claims it didn't have to validate, who should be receiving money, who shouldn't be. In fact, a second report found that they eliminated all of the checks that they had that would have prevented wide-scale benefits fraud from occurring. So the tally to date is that we have something like $111 billion distributed by EDD, including anywhere from $10 to $36 billion fraudulently obtained, an enormous amount of money that was needed. Like, people need this money still, and so like the sheer incompetence leading to something like 33% of the money handed out going to people who were obtaining it illegally is now a major scandal, and it comes at a bad time for Gavin Newsom. Alyssa, what was the new story from this week?
That they have over 1,000 people in recent weeks that have left these positions. So they had to hire more people, you know, during this whole time to make sure that they could, you know, help fulfill all these claims and talk to people. I don't know if you've talked to people who have been through this process.
Oh, yeah.
If you apply for unemployment, people have been on hold for hours. I think somebody posted something where they were on hold for like 12 hours or something like that to get help. We experienced it. My husband tried to get unemployment. You know, it was things got sent out. You would fill out your thing perfectly, and then it would send it back and said that you missed something when instead you actually hadn't missed something. I know people who had no money for weeks and maybe months because of this situation, you know, at a time when the federal government was completely MIA and you really have no other way to get help. so the latest like exodus is all these people who have just been completely fed up. They can't, they don't know who they're working for. They can't help people. They're, you know, they're just like, I can't do this job. And that we've lost some institutional knowledge, I guess, at the agency now. So you had people that actually were very good at these things or solving problems. And now you are hiring temp workers or people who have no familiarity. And on top of it, you have these massive IT problems that were raised, that were, you know, issues and red flags raised saying that your system is not ready to handle a flood of requests should you need it at a time. And they never fixed it. I mean, this was pre-pandemic, and we look back at it now and everybody says, oh, we wish we could have planned. But something like that, I mean, I've dealt with it too. When it's the same thing you go through when you do family leave. And I can tell you, I could tell you as someone who like had to go stare down that interface every day as a newborn, as the mother to a newborn who could barely see clearly anyway.
Yeah.
It was not set up in a way that I would expect the state that is like home to every tech giant in the world to be operating at that kind of level. I mean, it's embarrassing.
This is, I mean, so like I said, this is coming at a very bad time for Gavin Newsom, this scandal, which is rapidly expanding. Newsom's recall opponents just qualify, according to them, they have enough signatures to qualify for the ballot. Now, of course, they have plenty more time to continue collecting signatures, but the EDD's handling of
I wanted to say just where the signatures exactly are at. They have submitted the number to qualify them to get on the ballot. There's no way all of those signatures are good,
right?
Like they all get checked. That must be a really fun job. Speaking of terrible jobs that we're talking about here, but like so far their success rate for signatures has been like 85%. They're going to get this done.
Yeah. They're going to get it.
They are going to get it.
I can't even really reckon with what we're headed into with this. I'm just not capable of it. It's
Let's
chaos.
Finish talking about EDD, and then we can talk about my nightmares keeping me up at night. But yes, I agree with you.
Absolutely.
I'm freaking out.
Going to take over a large part of this year. Julie Sue, another piece of new news from this week, in a story by Patrick McGreevy from the LA Times, of course, picked up nationally as well. Julie Sue has been nominated for the deputy secretary position at U.S. Department of Labor, which guarantees, I mean, Biden administration, whatever, I mean, there are clear and well-established ties between the Biden administration and Gavin Newsom's administration in California at this point. And the Biden spokesperson came out this week and said, we absolutely do not support the recall of Gavin Newsom, of course, but they're not really not doing him favors either. This nomination for a position that will be up for Senate confirmation guarantees that this EDD scandal is going to gain even more national prominence. And national Republicans are funding the hell out of this Newsom recall. Mm-hmm. And so this is not going to be a story that goes away anytime soon. I do want to talk just briefly about perhaps my favorite angle of this EDD story, which is some of the most information that we have about how people are committing welfare fraud in these cases comes from, in particular, one song by the rapper Nuke Bizzle, who is currently in federal custody, partially because of his song EDD. Can I play you guys just like a little?
Oh yeah, I've been waiting to hear this
because it's kind of a bop. I enjoy it. Hold on a second, let me get through this ad.
August 29th, 2020. The available balance on this account is $21,000. You know, 2020, the unbelievable. Shadow. I just been swiping for EDD. Go to the bank, get a stack at least. This shit here better than selling peas. I made some racks that I couldn't believe. 10 cars, they're 200 bun. I got a shot at the Donald Trump. I just might swipe me a lone song.
Okay, this is a music video by Nuke Bizzle, EDD featuring Fat Wizza. And it is, the entire music video is them holding envelopes from EDD. The EDD logo is on the music video. It's entirely about doing identity theft scams to get checks from EDD. And the reason why this is a big part of the scandal is because the EDD as an agency early on in the pandemic, they said they were waiving all of the, in order to get checks out to people faster. Again, the state auditor said that they were responding to like 1% of calls that came in. They had like a 4 to 6 week wait time for people validly seeking state and federal assistance. But in order to get checks out faster, they were basically eliminating any kind of validation process for most types of unemployment claims. So Nuke Bizzle, in a remarkable act of artistic honesty, walks through the process of doing a scam like this, which is then now, I guess, corroborated by the U.S. Attorney's Office, who arrested him or is charging him with benefits fraud. He stole identities from numerous people who had never lived in or worked in California and used the same background story for each of them. They were living at his rented mansion in Beverly Hills. They were self-employed barbers who had lost work because all of the barbershops are closed. Eight of these people, none of whom live in California, all had the same story. All were living either at his Beverly Hills mansion or another address in Koreatown. And these checks were just cut without any questions asked. EDD did not raise a red flag, nothing. And so, Nuke Bizzle collected $1.2 million off of EDD, made a music video to celebrate it, and then was subsequently arrested. These are the allegations against him, of course. I don't think he's pled guilty.
And at the beginning, you can hear that hold. The whole message.
That's the whole music. Let him out.
This is the song that'll be played at all the Recal Newsom rallies for the rest of the year.
You know, and like this is another one of those things, like we were talking about with the vaccinations, where there was a decision to be made at the beginning, it seems like, between speed and effectiveness with getting these things out. And in this case, they chose neither.
Yeah.
But it's something that I don't feel like we talk about enough in general. We talk about like getting these programs passed, like getting money signed off on to give to people who need it. We don't talk about implementation enough. And we very often moved on to the next program before there's really any oversight or like understanding of how much funding is needed, like what it's going to take to have these programs be effective. So they're just garbage.
I mean, these seem really bad. Like, I mean, not having the ability.
Terrible.
These not like not having the ability to determine, or even just like to say, like, we've gotten 8 requests from the same address in Beverly Hills, all with the same occupation, all et cetera, et cetera. No evidence of them actually living in California at any point in time.
And we don't even know the extent of the grift. I mean, they found that like a certain number, a huge number of people who had received EDD were inmates. But my guess is that it's not those inmates necessarily getting the money. It's people who have signed up those inmates as being eligible for EDD, and it's being sent to their personal address.
Right.
All of these, and so this extends to me too, like to the rent relief programs that are now about to be administered by the city, county of LA, by the state of California. We saw $100 million go out from the CARES Act to city of LA. There was an immediate run on the system for applicants to that program. And I believe all of it has been distributed. The run on the system could mean that there's just like that much desperation out there that word got out that this money was available and like people went after it. I think it's just as likely that the people that are most likely to sign up for these, to know about them, sign up for them really quickly, are taking advantage of the system in some way. That's not a reason not to do these programs, but it's just acknowledgement. It happened with PPP. It's happened with every single one of these other mass distribution campaigns. And if you want these to get to the people that will be kept healthy and housed and safe from them, you do need to inject more oversight into the program, even if it costs more money, even if it means a little less money going out. One thing I
would say is that when you put together a system, so let's use a different example, and it would be the direct payments made by the federal government. Like, when you put together a system that is intentionally extremely Byzantine, like unemployment insurance, where we care so much about welfare fraud that we have to make this system as difficult to use as possible, then you are necessitating the creation of those oversight mechanisms and things like that. If you compare the direct payments, which just like, you know, just, you can just send them out to everyone, or mm-hmm. if you are really racist like the U.S. is, you can send them out to everyone except for undocumented immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
But like, if you just send the money to everybody and don't try to do the whole means testing thing, it makes it a lot harder to do these kind of fraudulent payments, because you're just like, I'm just sending this to everybody who is, if you were the state of California and you were just sending it to everybody who has evidence of working here. The state has that evidence. They don't need the people who live here to provide it to them. We've created this system where there is simultaneously more fraud and also a more expensive administration system. And I think that mm-hmm. Republicans in general and Republican media have picked up on the EDD story as this is, I mean, and also Ezra Klein have picked up on this story as evidence of, like, why should Americans trust liberals when this is how liberal administrations look? Really, though, PPP, as you mentioned, the small business loans for Trump's administration were, if anything, more corrupt and more fraught with grift. And it's it's really the only thing that seems clear is that administration at all levels in this country has atrophied to a point where we cannot successfully administer the types of programs that are being put together by politicians. And all of it is basically just shit wall to wall.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to LA Podcast. Thank you for subscribing to our Patreon at patreon.com/LA Podcast. We will be back next week. Bye.